John Masters, right. How many of you actually went and looked that up somewhere on when I sent you that? Yes, you looked it up like on the internet or something like that. Yeah, John Masters. You had to look it up. Oh, man. Well, how many of you knew it before you had to look it up? John Masters, you honestly knew. I had a couple of emails from folks. I saw Diane the other night, and she told me, yeah. So, Diane, I guess you get the prize. I guess we got to get a prize. I don't think we're going to have one, but it sounds good. So, I was going to give away a couple of shoe boxes. I don't know what they were for, but they've already auctioned those off. So sorry about that. Here's what I want you to do. We're going to talk about friendship today. And what I want you to do is write down at the top of your outline four words. All right, four words. Actually, I want you to put a couple of lines in a couple of places. At the first one, I want you to put a line. Just draw a straight line across. We're going to fill in that blank in a few moments. And then the second word I want you to put below that is manipulation. Remember, we talked about that last week. We talked about motivation versus manipulation. And then right below that, I want you to put another line, okay? And we're going to fill that one in just a moment. Then below that, I want you to put in motivation. We talked about motivation last week. Remember, people typically live their lives in one of a couple of different ways. We're going to bring up two more today in terms of the way they handle their relationships. But people can be manipulative, and they can also be motivational. Motivational folks are kind of like Andy. Andy finds ways, right, to make Barney what? Look successful, to make him look good. Andy's highest calling in life, it seems, if you watch that show through the five seasons that Barney was on there, is the theme is always Andy building up Barney. You know, Andy's one of the greatest friends in the world, isn't he? He's a guy that we would all love to emulate. We should try to emulate because he's a guy who lives his life via motivation. But I want to introduce to you a couple of other words today before we get into this, because we're going to look at a couple of people, kind of a new character today, and then we're going to look at a character that we were looking at last week that in a way demonstrate both of these characteristics. In that top blank that I asked you to draw, I want you to write the word oppression. 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 All right? And then in the second blank, which would be the third word in your order, I want you to write the word enablement. All right? Enablement. Because generally I believe that now as we're talking about this story today, we are capturing in these two consecutive weeks four major ways that people typically deal with others in their relationships. All right? The oppressive person, that person who lives by oppression, is the person who uses brute power, strength, whether that be strength of personality, intellect, or even the threat of physical strength to get others to do what they want them to do. Does that make sense? All right, there's almost a power element there that a person will use on another to try to get them to do what they want to do or what they want them to do. And so that's what the oppression is about. Manipulation is about that subtle, as we talked about last week, kind of playing mind games and that kind of thing, trying to get people to do things for the benefit of the individual. All right, if I'm a manipulator, my goal is to try to find ways that I can make other people do things without them knowing it necessarily, or maybe thinking that it's their idea, but in reality, who does it wind up benefiting in the long run? Me as the manipulator. All right, that's the second type of person. The third type of person is the enabler. The enabler we're going to meet today, and his name, I believe, is Jonathan. And Jonathan is enables some bad, oppressive behavior of his father. And the enabler is a person who does what? Who allows those who have unhealthy character traits to do what? To continue to perpetuate those, right? And because for a number of reasons, they feel that gives them a sense of significance. Maybe there's a sense of fear about the person that they're enabling, a fear of retribution or of consequences that may be there if they don't enable them. And then many people just think, many enablers just simply think, I'm helping that person do what they want to do, all right? And really what people want to do oftentimes is not what they ought to do. You got that? There's a huge gap in so many situations. And so we see the enabler. Jonathan's an enabler today, as we're going to see a little bit of that, as we're going to move through this very quickly. And finally, the motivator is that person we talked about, Andy. That's the person who maybe tries to get people to do things and kind of plant ideas in their heads, right? And the motivator is a person, a coach is a great example, who tries to get their players to do things, the right things, and in the process helps them to think ultimately that it is their idea in the first place. That's a great example of a motivator. Because in the end, the beneficiary of that is not the person who's doing the motivation, but the person who's what? On the other end, who's receiving the motivation. That's the type of person that we talked about last week. And we saw that in David. So we're going to be talking about these four ways of dealing with relationships off and on during the course of this series. Now, unfortunately, marriages can often be categorized in one or two of these characteristics. Most marriages, almost all marriages, for example, and dating relationships can be thrown in, and we can find certain of these characteristics that would generally describe what is going on in the relationship of that marriage. And anything that is not based on motivation is an unhealthy situation. Okay? Any situation that is not based purely on motivation is an unhealthy situation. I don't care whether it's parent-child, I don't care whether it's friend-friend, I don't care whether it's supervisor, subordinate, I don't care whether it's husband and wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever the case might be. Now, the people that have the stronger personalities are those that have, we got a lot to watch out for, because we can very easily move out of motivation into one of the other areas very quickly without recognizing it. This happens very subtly. One of the things I love to say about my 17-year-old daughter, she is great at being a leader. She, among her friends, she's the one who gets people together, who gets them to do things and that kind of thing. And I've been telling her a lot lately. I said, you amaze me at your ability to get your friends to do what you think they ought to do and making them think that it's their idea. And she just tells me I'm full of it. You know, she says, I don't know what you're talking about. But, you know, in reality, she has that ability. And I have to rein her in sometimes and say, look, you got to be very careful that doesn't turn into manipulation. And that you don't allow that to be turned back for your own benefit, but rather you use that ability that God has given you, that influential quality, to do that and to be a person who helps others find positive things, to be the Andy to Barney, if you know what I mean. So as we go through this story today, I want you to notice a couple things that we're going to kind of hone in on. We're going to cover two chapters in chapters 19 and 20. Tim, we're probably not going to go through the scripture, each individual scripture. We're going to go in blocks. And I'm going to give you about five things that really characterize what authentic friendship really is. And at the same time, we're going to look at some of the character traits that we see in this guy, Jonathan, who is an incredible guy. He was a wonderful guy, don't get me wrong. But in the end, it appears, and again, I say it appears because I didn't live back then, all right? I didn't observe this firsthand. I can read what the story says, what Scripture says, and I can draw my own conclusions. But I do believe that Jonathan had this character, these characteristics, particularly when it came to his father, of being somewhat of an enabler. So we go to chapter 19, and we see what happens. Now, we're fresh off this situation that we looked at last week over in chapter 18, where we saw the jealousy of Saul, and we saw that lead him to a manipulative lifestyle. Remember the story, after the conquest of Goliath and the Philistines, they came back and all the ladies were going, yeah, Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. You remember that? And we remember what happened. Nothing good came out of that. We saw the attempted murder, if you will, of David by Saul. And then we saw toward the end of the chapter, pretty much where this marriage with Michal took place, everything Saul seemed to try to do, God would counter somehow, and David would always come out on the successful end. Well, today we're kind of segueing into a different story that's not totally unrelated. And to be honest with you, I had to really figure out what the chronology of this chapter is. Because part of me wanted to say, okay, the chronology again is kind of messed up, or not messed up, but there is a way of writing here that Samuel wanted to set a larger picture, and then he takes us back to go into the details. But what I found out was, best I can tell, that's not what happened. We pretty much have a rather sequential story here. The events and the writings, as they are recorded in these two chapters, give us a good feel for what actually happened and the order in which they happened. So, with that in mind, let me call to your attention the first part of this chapter. We see in the first 10 verses, as we look at this, we see that in spite of Jonathan's confrontation with Saul. Now, what happens here? Jonathan goes to Saul because Jonathan is catching a whim somehow that his dad is trying to do something to David. And he doesn't like that. Why? Because David and Jonathan have become very good friends, correct? They're good buddies. They really tend to get along with each other. And so in this conversation, after this conversation has taken place, where Jonathan simply says, look, you should not do any harm to this guy, we see Saul coming back in verse 6 and 7, simply saying this. He said, look, I am not going to harm your friend David. I'm not going to do anything to him. He will be safe. Now keep in mind, there is the complicating factor of an evil spirit that comes and kind of sets upon Saul, and causes him to lose some of his sanity, actually, and to do things that seem to be contrary to what he really wants to do. So one of the real questions that I have through this whole story is, where does Saul end and where does the evil spirit begin? And what are the influences thereof? It's an incredible story. But that question, I believe, will continue, no pun intended, to haunt me until I want to know this. I want to know how this thing works out. Well, here Saul restores David to his position at a high level in the army. All right, puts him back over as a military commander, a strategist, a field general, commander-in-chief, etc. And then war breaks out, all right? And when war breaks out, those who thrive and who are courageous and who thrive on crisis, when the crisis breaks out, that's when those who really do thrive on crisis, that's when they show up. And that's when they really begin to demonstrate their excellence. And so that's what happens again. Many of us, in we're talking about relationships, when the crisis comes, many of you can stay cool as a cucumber. You know what to do. You can navigate the crisis. You can move through it. And you know what? Everybody's all the better for it as you move through that. Others, when a crisis occurs, we panic. We do something stupid. We forget logic. We forget sense. And we just react. We do a knee-jerk reaction. Well, David was the first kind of guy that when the crisis broke out, his courage and his calm, coolness and collectiveness, but really began to grow and really began to come to the surface. And so guess what happens? War breaks out, which was probably the worst thing that could happen to Saul. Because David now, what? David has a chance to, we see him rise again to the top. His courage takes the day, and you know what? He becomes successful all over again. And we see that success. So he defeats the Philistines, and Saul's jealousy comes back through. We see once again, Saul always seems to have this what? This spear at his side. And this spear is probably stuck in the ground, and so he pulls it up and hurls it at David, right? He hurls it at David. Well, that's going to lead us into some other stuff that we see in these couple of chapters in this story. So there's a couple of things I want us to pick up. I want us to pick up on this thing. The question being, what are some of the evidences of authentic friendship? What are some of the evidences of authentic friendship? Because we see this in Jonathan. Although we see that Jonathan is an enabler, and we'll get to that in a couple of minutes, Jonathan was also a very good friend to David. And what are some of those? The first one is this, as we see this in, we saw it back in verse number 2, and that's it. That authentic friendship has the maturity to deliver difficult messages. This was a difficult thing for Jonathan to do, to go to his father and say what? He said back in verse 2, he said this, my father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you, David. Be on your guard tomorrow morning, go into hiding and stay there. He had to be brutally honest with his good friend because he knew that the message that he had received somehow from his dad was that David's life was in danger. David is his good friend, and so he feels like he's got to warn him. We don't avoid telling friends the things that they need to know, as unpleasant as they may be. The second thing that we get out of that is found in verses 4 and 5, and that's this, that authentic friendship has the courage to confront on behalf of friends. So we see in the next couple of verses where Jonathan goes to his dad. And Jonathan says to his dad, let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory over all, for all Israel, and you saw it and were glad. So leave him alone, Dad. I know what I hear you saying. I know what I hear you saying. But, you know, leave him alone. It's not the right thing to do. Do we have the courage to go to bat for our friends to deliver messages to those who really have more authority than we do? When we see them doing what? When we see them getting out of line? That's a big question that we have to ask. So we move into the next set of scriptures, beginning in verse 11. And so Saul, fresh off this proclamation, oh, I'm going to take care of David. He restores David to the place of power, right? He goes in and he defeats the Philistines. So Saul's anger comes out again. And we see that rather rapidly. So he sends men to Saul's house. Saul sends men to David's house. And in the meantime, David and Michal are married, right? So Michal, remember, if you remember from last week's story, Saul had the idea that if I plant my daughter in the house of David as his wife, she might be able to act as what? A reconnaissance agent or spy for me. Well, he got the idea wrong. And so Michal somehow found out about the fact that Saul was sending his people to come after David. And so she basically warns him and of the plot and helps him get away. He flees. And so what does she do? She takes an idol, and we're not sure what that idol looks like, except it was most likely life-size because of how the idol was used. And this, by the way, kind of goes back to kind of give you an idea of the impact of Michal on David. There was an idol in the home, most likely as a result of the pluralistic religious worship practices that Saul had gotten into, which was passed on to his daughter. Does that make sense? So the influence of Saul on Michal caused them to have a pagan, false worshiping, okay, idol, if you will, in the house. And so she takes the idol, kind of gets something to kind of make it look like there's some hair there, puts it under the cover of the bed to make it look like there's David. Well, the guys come from Saul to get David, and she says, well, he's very ill. Now, this is somewhat of a providential twist of fate, I believe, that would allow David some more time to get further away. Because if you're sent by the king to go get somebody to kill him anyway, does it really matter to you if he's sick? Does it really matter that he's sick? And so these guys come back to Saul and they say, well, we wanted to get him, but you know what? He was sick. Now, it's possible that these guards didn't know that Saul had intended to kill him. That is possible. But by and large, I think they probably did know that David was doomed in Saul's eyes. And so what happens here is Saul basically says, no, I want you now. I want to take this in my own hands. Bring him back to me, he says. Why? So that Saul himself could kill him. Now here again, we see Saul kind of losing control. You're the king you're the leader of the known world, all right? And so you want to send some guys out to do your dirty work for you, which is not a good idea in the first place. And they don't get it done. And so what happens? Well, bring them to me. I'll do it myself. Well, that's not real smart either. So Saul is continually progressively losing it, or should I say regressively losing it. He's losing his judgment. He's losing his wisdom. This evil spirit thing that's going on with him is really taking a toll on him. So all this time, David gets further and further and further away. Well, when Saul, when they come and they find again, they pull back the covers and there's the idol. They realize the ruse has been on them. They ask Michal, and they take Michal basically to Saul. And he said, why did you do this? Why did you deceive me like this and send my enemy away so that he could escape? Well, Michal's a pretty sly lady. She learned from maybe the best. And so we see in the last part of verse 17, he said to me, Michal said, let me get away. Why should I kill you? In other words, she says to her dad, he threatened to kill me if I didn't let him get away and if I didn't do this. All right. So she's kind of sly herself. So she's here. She's telling her dad a lie in order to protect her own survival. Okay, so she's a fairly shrewd young lady. Then we kind of move into chapter 18. We see verse 18. We see David fleeing to Samuel's home place, known as Ramah. Now, Samuel is not, you know, he has really kept his contact with Saul at a very minimum. He doesn't really want to have anything to do with him. Samuel himself knows that he may be in danger. There's a hair on there. I keep looking at y'all and I'm seeing hair, so I'm getting the hair out. But anyway, got it off. And so he goes there because David knows that's a safe place. Samuel's a guy who's been successful. He's a guy who's been protective of him in the past. And so he's going there to try to find some refuge. And so he's going there for protection. When his men, and then Saul, of course. Saul, by the way, the king, has an incredible system of surveillance all around the country. By the way, if you're not aware of it, even to this day, the nation of Israel has probably the most sophisticated spy, reconnaissance, intelligence agencies around the whole world. Why? They've had to, because everybody's been trying to wipe them off the face of the earth for as long as they've been in existence, right? And so what we're seeing here is, you know, just another example, an iteration of that, even dating back to the time of Saul. And so Saul finds out where David's gone. He goes to Ramah, and so he sends a group of men. Now, this is kind of funny. My guess is that Samuel had a group of prophets that worked for him. And so when they got there, when Saul's men got there to try to find David and to pick him up and bring him back, they find this group of prophets prophesying. And we talked about that a few weeks ago. We're not really sure exactly what that means. It may mean that it has something to do with them proclaiming words that come directly from God. Other places, some of the translation might mean that relates to some uncontrolled ecstatic behavior. We're not really sure what that means. It could be a combination. But regardless, this prophesying thing going on, we see these prophets doing this, and all of a sudden, the men who Saul has sent to Ramah to bring David back, all of a sudden, they start doing the same thing. They come under this spell, almost, and so he hears about it, and so he sends a second group of men, right? Guess what? They start doing the same thing. He sends a third group. Guess what? They start doing the same thing. Now, my guess is here that God's doing one of three things. This is either a diversionary tactic, where he's, again, trying to give David more time to get away. It may be an event of irony that saw these men doing something so unnatural. Or it may be an expression to Saul of, you know what, if this is real, you know, you could have been somebody who's really effective and faithful to me. You really could. You could have been another Samuel or someone who was as righteous as Samuel. Because Saul himself decides to go to Ramah. And guess what happens when he gets there? He starts doing the prophesying thing himself. So basically what happens is they are paralyzed with regard to the mission that they originally had, which was to find David and to carry him away and ultimately to kill him. So we end up chapter 19 with the question where people are looking at Saul, who's doing all this stuff with the prophets in terms of prophesying, and they say something like this: is Saul also among the prophets? Is he also among the prophets? So that's the big question. So we move into chapter 20, and we see David fleeing from this place, from Ramah, and this is where we begin to see Jonathan become more and more evident. And here's where we see, I think, Jonathan being somewhat of an enabler of bad behavior. And we start out the chapter with Jonathan talking to David. And it appears by what he says as David comes to Jonathan, he says, How have I wronged your father? What have I done that makes him so angry with me? And Jonathan said, no, you're not going to die. In verse 2, look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without consulting or confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so. Does this sound a little weird to you? Because we began chapter 19 again in sequence with chapter 20, and we see where Saul was telling his people what? As well as Jonathan, get David and kill him. Get David and kill him. Yet when Jonathan is with his friend, David, he says, "No, my dad's not mean any harm to you. He's just blowing smoke." However, Jonathan did know about a couple of the times where the spear was hurled at David. Jonathan also knows, or doesn't know yet, but the spear would be hurled at him a little bit later in the story. So here, it's very possible that Jonathan is simply in denial about his dad. He's denying the reality of his dad's behavior. And because of that, he's letting him get away with it, but he's allowing it to continue. And you know what? He's actually putting his friend David in a very precarious position. A position of great, great, great danger. Well, in this particular passage, we see Jonathan being willing, ultimately, in verse 4, to find out the truth about his dad. And so he says to David, "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do for you." That leads us to our third point about authentic friendship. It takes a whatever it takes approach in a relationship. In authentic friendship, we see a whatever it takes approach in relationships. If I'm truly a friend to you, if I truly am in relationship with you, in a loving, Christ-like, godly friendship, I will do whatever it takes to make sure that what you benefit. But so many relationships that fall into the category of oppression and of enablement are just the opposite. I will do whatever it takes to get you to allow you to do what you want to do, as self-destructive as it might be. You got that? That's the way many people live their lives. They enable the self-destructive behavior on the part of someone else. Why? Because it helps them to feel like they're accomplishing something and they want to feel significant. They want to feel needed. And you know what? If I can help somebody do what they want, then you know what? I feel good about myself. Now, that person might be really screwing things up, all right, making a mess of their own life. But guess what? They're doing what they want to do. Well, we see, I really think that a big question that I have around this chapter, one, again, that really kind of bothers me, is the one of what does Jonathan really know about his father's intentions about David? What does Jonathan really know? And what is he suppressing? What is he denying? You know, we deny a lot of stuff. We deny reality. I know of people today who are just kind of like they don't get involved in social issues. They don't get involved in current trends. They don't worry. They don't want to know what's going on in the world around them, say in our nation or in the world. But you know, it's a form of denial. It's a form of denial. When in reality, we'd better get up on what's going on. Because there are things going on that are going to affect your children and my children incredibly. Stuff just this past week. And I'm not talking about Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett. All right? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about stuff that's going on in legislative halls. I'm talking about stuff that's going on internationally that are going on. And you know what? We cannot be in denial about this stuff, but we've got to understand it. We've got to pray about it. And we've got to ask God to intervene. Well, as we see in verses 5 and 10, David and Jonathan begin this conversation. The question is he really trying to kill David? All right? Is he really trying to kill David? So they agree on a scheme. And so they said, David says, "Look, let's play this deal, you know, because David is still in Saul's service, right? And so being in Saul's service, he eats at the table with the king. And the time was coming for the new moon festival, which is a big deal. It's a big big feast time. And so David was supposed to eat with Saul and his group. And so what happens is David says, "Just tell him that I'm called back to Bethlehem. I'm called back to Bethlehem for what? For a sacrifice with my family." And so what you do is you tell him I'm not here. And so that happens the first day. The first day of the New Moon Festival, Saul asks where David is. He's called. He's called away. Now the first day. Now that was the second day. What happened? I'm trying to get a lot in here. The first day, what happens? It was kind of like he's not feeling well. Da da da. The second day is when Jonathan tells Saul David has been called back, and so David is left, but in all the while he is hidden, at a place out in a field near the palace, near a place called the Rock of Ezal, E-Z-A-L. He's hiding there, waiting, because in this conversation, during this feast, the idea is that Jonathan is going to discover the true intention of his father Saul toward David. And so what happens when the second day David is not at the table for the feast, all you know what, he breaks loose. Saul goes berserk. He picks up the spear at his side and guess what? Throws it at his son, Jonathan. And so at that point, Jonathan knows. He knows. My dad is out to kill my good friend, David. Well, this was a moment of truth for Jonathan. It was a big time moment of truth. And it was a difficult time for Jonathan. And so what happens is Jonathan now goes out into the field after he leaves with a great sense of anger. And he shoots three arrows. Now, this was part of the ruse. I encourage you to go back and read this passage in chapter 20. Because he shoots three arrows and he sends a little boy after him. And he calls to the little boy with a message. And the message was designed to let David know, who would be hearing the message, was designed to let him know almost in a coded sense, in a code, what Saul's real intentions were. And so bottom line, what happens is this. The message goes out to the little boy. David hears it and he knows that he must flee because Saul is truly after him. And Jonathan has come to the reality and he's come to the conclusion that yes, my dad is really who David has said he was. And you know what? My dad is the same dad who told us at the beginning of chapter 19 to bring David to him so that he could kill him. So in a very heartbreaking scene at the end of chapter 20, we see David and Jonathan having to part ways. Now in the meantime, Jonathan, in another example of the fact that he knew that David would be the successor to the throne, not himself, remember? Because the successor to the throne naturally from Saul would be who? Jonathan, right? In another example of the fact that he knew that that David would be the successor to the throne, he asks David in chapter 20, make sure that you bless my descendants. You bless my family. You take care of them. Of course, David says, of course, I will. I will do whatever it takes. Well, here's another question. Were David and Jonathan justified in concocting a scheme? A scheme. In order to determine Saul's intention and to help David get away. I mean, I think they were. I think they were. I think that was something that they had to do for self-protection. They had to discover the truth. And you see, because of the purity of Jonathan and David's heart, they could get away with doing that. Okay? Because their motives were pure. So some people would look at that and say, well, I guess it's okay for me to scheme and kind of pull a ruse on somebody else just to try to find something out. No, it depends on your motivation. Are you living a life of oppression? Are you living a life of manipulation? Are you living a life of enablement? You know, you can only do that kind of thing if you're living a life of motivation and motivating others. And so Jonathan and David had every right to do that, and they had every reason to do that. Well, the story goes that Jonathan sticks around the palace. He stays there and he does his job. After the heartbreaking departure of David, where he has to begin his life as a fugitive. What I admire about Jonathan so much is that through it all, he didn't run away either. He stuck around because he said, you know what? My dad's messed up. You know what? I got to be around to try to correct some of the stuff that he really does. I got to keep an eye on him. I've got to make sure that he doesn't go too far. And the rest of the chapter kind of gives us an idea that Jonathan's commitment to stick around. So Jonathan, in all this convoluted story, he basically has this love, this devotion to David, which is based on true and authentic friendship. As a matter of fact, we see back in verse 17 the fact that authentic friendship is going to always thrive in times of crisis. You see, once Jonathan knew the truth, he began to really step up. And then we see down in verses 41 and 42, based on the commitment that they made to each other, that authentic friendship is sustainable regardless of physical proximity. Authentic friendship is sustainable regardless of physical proximity. They would remain great friends, although they would be apart from now. So my question to you is, are you living a life of motivation? If you're living a life of motivation, you're living a life of authentic friendship to those that you come into relationship with. And these five characteristics are things that become characteristic of you as an individual. Here's the point. God is a God of relationships. God is a God who looked at the relationship between David and Jonathan and saw something that he was really pleased with. He saw someone who lived a life, he saw a couple of guys who lived lives of motivation where they had purity in their heart. And you know what? That purity led them to try to find the best for each other. You know, that's what salvation's all about. Where God allows us to enter into this type of relationship with Him. Why? Because He's the one that defines this type of relationship for us. All these things we said that are characteristic of authentic friendship are characteristic or character points that are already resident in the personality of God Himself, in Jesus Christ. As a matter of fact, many people would say that Jonathan and David's relationship is what's known as a type of the relationship or a foreshadowing of the relationship that God would intend between Jesus and us as individuals. Unconditional love is a big part of it. That's exactly what they experienced. So my question to you today is, where in those four categories do you fall in terms of relationships? We talked about a couple of them last week. Manipulation, motivation. Enablement, oppression. The only place to live in a God groove, as I'll call it, in a path and in a direction that He wants us to go, is to live in a life of motivation. Helping others be everything that they can be for themselves. Protecting, growing, supporting, encouraging, even as we saw with Andy, maybe putting others in positions to succeed and going to great lengths to do it. Let's pray. Father, thank You for Your word. Thank You for the story of friendship that we see today. God, it's a great story. One that we probably could use another couple hours to talk about. But God, I pray that You will help us to understand what authentic friendship really is. It has to do with a relationship that is focused on You. It's a relationship that causes us to want to help others become better than they already are. God, thank You for Jonathan and David. Help us, Lord, to be able to see the contrast between them and Saul, this trio of characters that bring out so many different ideas and thoughts about relationships. Help us, God, to live lives of motivation, to pull away from unhealthy modes, unhealthy ways of doing things. Thank You for Your love and Your grace. Guide us and show us Your heart as we try to move forward in these relationships that You have given us the privilege of being in. And God, help us to do everything we can do to point others toward the relationship with Jesus Christ. For that is the most important thing. That is the prerequisite for us living lives of motivation. May we do that. May we live there with You. For it's in Christ's name that we pray. Amen. Thanks for being here today, guys and girls. Hope you have a great week of the 4th, right? And have a lot of fun celebrating. Don't forget to drop your Integrity Connection cards in the boxes in the back. And also, if you would, don't forget to drop your tithes and your offerings. Don't forget those, please, during the midsummer times in the box in the back. Also, there, we have some food for you.